Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage nephrologist, Dr. Jeremy Gittimer, and our topic is hypertension. If we have time, we'll get into some of the questions about kidney stones. Dr. Gittimer is trained in both pediatric and adult nephrology, so we have an expert in both ends of the spectrum. He trained at the University of Texas Medical School in Houston. He's been in Anchorage for about 8 years. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, you can reach us at 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, you can reach us during the program by email at line1, spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Jeremy, it's a pleasure to have you here for two reasons. One, I think a lot of you, and two, we've never done hypertension, so nice to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be here.
This is a topic that I can't believe we really haven't addressed in more ways, and I've already learned quite a bit from just having the opportunity to sit down and talk with you before the program. But before we get to hypertension specifically, I'd like to just go over for listeners why we have kidneys in the first place and what are their major functions. I'm sure there's some things that people don't know that the kidneys do for us.
Well, the kidney is incredibly complex. You know, every specialist says their organ's the most important organ in the body, and of course, I think the kidney is the most important organ. The kidney is in charge of separating out salt and water and excreting excess water that you bring in. So if you drink a gallon of fluid, you better get rid of it, otherwise you'll get swollen. So one job is just to maintain the fluid balance so that you don't swell or you don't become dehydrated. If you're out in the desert, you want to make sure that you don't make a lot of urine, that you'll conserve your fluid. The kidney's also in charge of electrolyte balance. Electrolytes are sodium and potassium and calcium, phosphorus, and the kidney manages these by interacting with other organs of the body, such as calcium by interacting with vitamin D receptors of the gut to make vitamin D work, with the parathyroid gland, with potassium working with the adrenal gland. So the kidney is in charge of keeping the sodium and potassium and calcium and phosphorus all in the normal range, and these are important so that your bodily functions will continue. The kidney is also in charge of managing blood pressure. And the kidney makes a hormone called renin when you're dehydrated. And the renin will cause a series of events to occur, which ultimately produce a vasoconstrictive agent called angiotensin II. Now, this vasoconstrictive agent is just a hormone that floats around to the blood vessels, causes them to contract as much as they possibly can, and that limits blood flow to your arms and legs. That forces the blood flow into the center of the body, and so you have more blood in the same space, so the pressure has to go up, and that will increase blood flow to the kidneys. So the kidney does a lot of different things. It manages, for diabetics, the kidney actually makes sugar. About 20% of the sugar load in the body is from the kidney, and then it gets rid of insulin. About half of the insulin is gotten rid of by the kidney, just through direct excretion in your urine.
So what are the primary reasons that an animal or a human in particular needs to control blood pressure, and to what degree is it controlled? How tightly controlled is blood pressure?
So blood pressure control is important because you want to make sure that at all times you get enough blood flow to your vital organs like your brain, your heart, your gut, and your lungs. So it's important to regulate your body in extreme circumstances. So if you are bleeding and you lose a significant amount of blood volume, you still need to maintain blood flow to your brain. Or if you're in the desert, or if you are not having access to water, you know, someone who breaks their hip and can't get to a faucet. So you want to be able to maintain blood flow to various organs, and the blood pressure is one way to regulate that blood flow.
Does it do anything else? Well, let's talk specifically. Let me ask you specifically how it monitors or controls blood pressure. You mentioned renin and the angiotensin II. Is there any other mechanism that we need to be aware of? And I guess I'm trying to get to the nervous system and these things called catecholamine, stress hormones, and so forth. How does that all interplay?
Well, there are receptors in the body called baroreceptors in your neck. Mm-hmm. And these receptors are actually sensing how much stretch the blood vessels in the neck receive every time the heart beats. And when they're not stretched enough, they sense that the brain isn't getting enough blood flow, and they send a signal out to the adrenal glands to produce cortisol, which is a stress hormone, and catecholamines, epinephrine. Both of these will result in your kidney conserving salt and water, thinking that you're dehydrated. You also will have other organs like in your fingertips. If you don't get enough blood flow to your fingertips, you'll develop lactic acid. Your muscles will not get enough oxygen, so they can't use energy in an appropriate fashion. This lactic acid will then, as it goes back into the body, will set off a cascade of events that will tell your kidneys to hold on to salt and water and raise your blood pressure in the setting of stress.
Okay. So that, for example, I guess one cause of hypertension might be some chronic stressful situations. If that happens, is there a reset of a thermostat, so to speak, so that it's a chronic condition, or is it depend on these stress hormones being excreted for to maintain itself, or do we know that?
Well, the stress hormones act on the blood vessels in two ways. One, they directly cause the blood vessels to contract, and these are the blood vessels in the arms and legs, and that will raise your blood pressure in the center of the body again. The second thing that happens is the stress hormones act as proliferative cytokines, and these are basically growth factors which tell the blood vessels under the setting of stress, and stress meaning that every time my heart beats and blood is flowing through the blood vessel, I'm stretching that blood vessel. And the shear force in that wall is a stress on the blood vessel wall. Now, normally, the response to stress would just be that nothing would happen. But in the setting of too much epinephrine, too much catecholamines, you'll actually have the response where the cells that line the blood vessel wall will be told to divide and get thicker in essentially order to prevent rupture. I mean, this is a mechanical
reflux kind of thing, yeah.
Exactly. And so if you have a prolonged stress reaction, you'll actually get thicker blood vessels. And we can measure that in your neck very easily by looking at the carotid intimal thickness, which is the thickness of the blood vessel that's very easy to look at. Mm-hmm. And so we know that patients who have extended periods of stress will actually have thickening. Now, when the stress is reduced, or let's say you're on a medicine that reduces the catecholamines or some of the growth factors, you can have thinning of those tissues over time.
So it's reversible to some degree.
Absolutely. And in fact, the holy grail of treatment is when I see someone in my office, I know if they have high blood pressure that they had blood vessel changes many years before they actually developed high blood pressure. In fact, if you will put two electrodes on their arteries spaced apart and you give that artery a signal, you'll see how hard the vessel contracts and how long it will contract before it relaxes. And patients who develop hypertension have changes in these motor activities for about 5 years before they truly develop high blood pressure. So they've had things happening. They're not acting normally for a long time before they truly finally get high blood pressure. And my goal as a clinician is to treat you so that 5 years from now, you're back to when you were 18.
So as we've learned about a lot of diseases on this program, it's what we're seeing is often the tip of the iceberg or the end, almost getting to the end. I mean, where we need to be addressing things is in the preclinical state almost, or before there's symptoms, because symptoms mean there's a lot of water that's gone over the bridge or over the dam, so to speak, especially with hypertension, it sounds like.
Right. With high blood pressure, I think this is pretty well recognized. The last big organization to come out with recommendations was the Joint National Commission on Hypertension number 7. And they say that normal blood pressure is under 120 over 80, and pre-hypertension is a blood pressure between 120 and 140 and 80 to 89. And the reason that they've recognized pre-hypertension is you don't have true high blood pressure. However, if you follow these patients for 3 years, about 30% will develop high blood pressure, and over 5 years, about 60 to 70% will develop high blood pressure. And if you intervene at that point with low salt diet, exercise, relaxation techniques, and even medical interventions, you can see that the patients will not develop high blood pressure.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're talking about hypertension today, and my guest is Dr. Jeremy Gittimer, a nephrologist, a kidney specialist, and hypertension expert who treats both kids and adults here in Anchorage. If you've got questions or comments, you can reach us during the program at 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is lineone, lineone at kska.org. Jeremy, let's define hypertension. You've already implied that there's some marker in the sand, and that really, even before we get to that marker, the prehypertensive designation or levels are also significant to be aware of. How are we going to define this thing?
Well, for kids, it's difficult. You actually take their age, their sex, and their height, and then we look at their 95th percentile blood pressure, meaning that in a classroom of kids who are all the same height, age, and sex, 95 of them are considered normal, and the top 5% have high blood pressure. And that's the standard way of looking at pediatrics. Now, the interesting thing is when you look now and you go to a high school in inner city Houston, 18% of all high school students have high blood pressure, even though it should only be the top 5%. So high blood pressure in pediatrics is defined based on your peer group. As you get into an adult, we define it based on data from these large databases like Framingham, where we've looked at what is your risk for a heart attack or a stroke. The ideal blood pressure is 115 over 70. That's perfect. Lower than that doesn't help you, but that is the true ideal. At 120 over 80, it's considered to be the upper limit of normal blood pressure. And once you get into the 120s systolic, which is the top number, and the 80s in the diastolic, which is the bottom number, that's considered abnormal. And we know that's abnormal because patients at that point in time will start having evidence of end organ damage, which means the high blood pressure has injured some organ, either their eyes, they've damaged the blood vessels of the eyes, or the heart has become thicker. Once you're over 140 over 90, that's considered true hypertension. And the next grade is, and that's called stage one hypertension, from 140 to 159 over 90 to 99. Stage two is above that, 160 over 100. Stage two is an important designation because the medications really aren't as good as we always want them to be. You get about 12 points for the top number for any pill you take. So the reason there's a stage two designation is there's no doubt that you'll need more than one medicine if you come into the office at 170 over 110 to get below your 140 over 90. Now, there are some special groups that need better blood pressure control. Diabetics, for example. Diabetics, 90% of all deaths for a diabetic are going to be heart attacks or strokes. They don't die of anything else. So the recognition of that is we need to have better blood pressure control because we want to avoid damage to the blood vessels of the heart and of the brain and the other organs. And so there was very nice trials in the 80s and 90s looking at diabetic control in England, and a 10-point reduction in the top number of blood pressure had a 44% reduction in heart attack and stroke rate. That's pretty impressive. It was actually much more profound than diabetic control. And so, again, the recognition that blood pressure control is really important. So anything over 130 over 80 for a diabetic or someone with congestive heart failure is considered hypertension in those particular categories.
What's happening to the vascular system? Let's just stick with that, with hypertension. What's going on with the heart? What's going on to those blood vessels? Although you've already kind of alluded to it. What's happening, and what's the consequences of those changes?
Well, the heart really is just a big blood vessel. I mean, blood flows through it, and it acts like a blood vessel. The blood vessels that are the arteries have muscles in them, just like the heart. And we've developed a lot of understanding looking at heart physiology. But the basic pattern is that there is some stressor, either high blood pressure or high blood sugar, that causes the cells that line the blood vessels of the body to react abnormally to stress, and they divide and they thicken abnormally. And as you thicken, it's harder to get blood through. So your thumbs and your fingers say, hey, I need more blood flow. So they actually make the body raise the blood pressure even more to get through these thickened vessels, which then get thicker and thicker. Now, in addition, you'll have injury to the blood vessel in its just daily work. You can imagine it's a moving part. It stretches every time the heart beats. And so when you have injury, you will have damage to some of these cells. And the normal way of replacing them is have a white blood cell go and gobble up the damaged cell. And then the cells next to that blank area would then fill in the space. Under the stress of high blood pressure and or diabetes, these white blood cells, they kind of cheat. And they'll actually grab cholesterol and use it as a patch on the blood vessel wall. This patch is very irritating to the cells around it. So they then want to cover it up. And so this is what happens in your heart as you have cholesterol disease. And so then you narrow the blood flow and you have more of these proliferative cytokines or growth factors that are produced when they really shouldn't be. And so this type of damage will happen in the blood vessels going to your limbs. So you can have lack of blood flow to the limbs or peripheral arterial disease. And that can give you numbness and tingling and blue feet and cold hands and feet. It also can happen to the blood vessels to your heart. So you can lose heart function or have heart attacks. Your heart itself will get thicker, and that's a huge problem because the oxygen delivery to the heart doesn't make any sense to me. It's got all this blood that's going through it. It should be easy to get oxygen, but that's not how the heart gets oxygen. The blood vessels actually, to deliver oxygen to the heart, go outside the heart and then pierce the muscle of the heart, giving oxygen as the blood is going into the heart. So if you have a thicker heart, sometimes there's no oxygen left at the very inner layer. And so you can have heart attacks that aren't based on lack of blood flow or blockages, but actually just lack of availability to get enough oxygen to the inner lining. So all of these will eventually end up with heart attacks or lack of blood flow to your limbs. And of course, stroke is another concern. You get thickening of the blood vessels in the neck, and you can have pieces of these cholesterol just break off in what we call a plaque rupture, and they can fly into the brain causing strokes, or you can have narrowing of the blood vessels to the brain.
And all this increased blood pressure puts extra work on the heart muscle itself.
Absolutely. So high blood pressure over time actually causes heart failure because the heart is now exposed to high levels of epinephrine all the time. Huh. And it's kind of like, you know, my wife telling me to do chores. She tells me all the time, and somehow I've just stopped doing them. That's the way the heart responds. The heart just says, I'm tired of listening, and it has this catecholamine fatigue, and it no longer can respond to epinephrine. And so the hearts then begin to fail. And the keys to therapy nowadays are to blunt the actual catecholamine, the epinephrine effects on the heart. So we give beta blockers, which block the effects of epinephrine. We give spironolactone or eplerenone, which blunt that same effect.
So I want to make sure that listeners hear, these are all late signs and that somewhere along the line, people have to have their blood pressures checked to see where they're going. Ideally, we want to find it before you get these symptoms.
Absolutely. In fact, we love finding these early because frequently, if we catch you before you become hypertensive and institute some minor dietary modifications and some lifestyle modifications, we can prevent you from developing high blood pressure. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you won't get a heart attack. You may have genetic predispositions to it, but it sure will decrease your risk significantly. And it's also, it's easier than taking medication. It's easier than waiting till you have lack of blood flow to your foot and have to worry about your foot getting taken off because you've developed a dry gangrenous ulcer.
Another thing you said I want to clarify in my own mind, and maybe it's my misunderstanding. So what I'm hearing you say about cholesterol plaques and the development of it is it appears from what you said it has a lot to do with a response to injury due to hypertension is a big reason there. I think many of us are thinking it's dietarily, you know, high cholesterol, bad high-density lipoprotein, HDL, those kinds of things that are the triggering factor. But am I misunderstanding you, or are you saying that really the evidence suggests there's a different horse going on here?
Well, I think that the cholesterol getting, you know, placed in the wall of the blood vessel can happen during the injury to the blood vessel from anything. Now, high blood pressure, because the forces on the wall are greater, you get more injury. Mm-hmm. But smoking is directly toxic to the cells that line the blood vessels. And so so the tobacco would cause the same injury.
I got you.
Just like diabetes, where you have high blood sugar, which causes injury. So the high blood pressure plays a role in all of these. Mm-hmm. For example, if you smoke a cigarette, your blood pressure goes up 20 points after the first cigarette of the day, and it remains elevated till you stop smoking that day. So, you know, some of these things are probably coexisting at the same time.
Okay, I got you. All right, let me remind listeners again, we're discussing hypertension with Dr. Jeremy Gitteber, an Anchorage nephrologist. If you've got questions or comments about treatment, the development of hypertension, variability, I do have one email I'll get to in a second that talks about how to measure that. And that's actually where we'll probably be going next, is how do we really measure this problem accurately. But if you've got questions or comments, our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433, toll-free 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@kska.org. All right, so it seems like it's rather straightforward and easy. You put something on your arm, you pump it up, and you measure blood pressure. What's happening day to day, minute to minute, hour to hour with blood pressure, and then how accurate can we as patients accurately determine and physicians determine what our blood pressure is?
Well, the blood pressure changes all the time. In fact, the best predictor of death is that your blood pressure doesn't respond to stress. So your blood pressure is supposed to go up and down. If it doesn't change, you're in trouble. That means that your nervous system is shot. Mm-hmm. So that makes it difficult, though. You come into the office, you're nervous about seeing your provider. Maybe you had injections last year. Maybe you have some other latent fear from what the doctors, you know, you're worried about them telling you that you need to stop doing this or that or the other. And that definitely raises blood pressure. So what appears now to be the most accurate is home blood pressure monitoring. Now, the way you do it is very important. You should not eat or drink for 30 minutes before. You should sit down for 5 minutes before you check. All of the home monitors are pretty accurate. I prefer the ones that go over the arm. A lot of people like the ones on the wrist because of convenience, and they inflate a little bit less so they don't hurt as much. But I don't think they're nearly as accurate, but they're still probably better than an office situation where you're nervous. You should then place the cuff at the level of your heart. That means on an arm cuff, that's easy. But on the wrist cuff, you actually have to hold your hand up a little bit so that it will measure it accurately. You then should measure it. In general, I tell people to measure sometimes in the morning, sometimes in the evening. Your morning actually is the highest blood pressure. About 5 a.m., everybody gets a cortisol surge, kind of gets you ready to get going in the morning. Of course, that's the time when most heart attacks occur, is 5 a.m. Hmm. And so your blood pressure goes up. At night, a lot of people who have swelling during the day will have lower blood pressures at night because they don't have as much blood volume. They've leaked it out into their legs. But most people at night, their blood pressures will tend to be kind of at the lowest point. And then when they go to sleep, their blood pressure drops about 10%. So for checking, I tell people to check a variety of times a day. Don't get upset if it's high at one point. You know, if you just had a car accident, don't check it. It'll be pretty high. If you just paid your mortgage, don't check it then. You probably want to find a time when you're pretty relaxed. At the same time, when you're at the office and you're in a doctor's office, the doctor's actually proven to be the worst person to check your blood pressure, although patients like it, and I like checking blood pressures. It kind of makes me connect with patients. But I probably raise the anxiety level of my patients about 10 to 15 points. You can check it with a device called an ambulatory blood pressure monitor, and a couple of the providers in town have these, and they'll measure this during the day every 15 minutes and every 30 minutes while you're asleep, just to give a better idea when you're not doing this yourself, you're not actively intervening. And for some people, that allows their blood pressure to be more accurate.
I have an email that we got before the program came on. It's from a woman who said her son is being monitored for hypertension. We have a blood pressure monitor that we purchased, but the results even back to back can vary dramatically. It shakes her confidence in how well it's working. Please advise me whether a variation in the top number, the systolic from 143 to 142, or 143 to 132 to 119 within minutes is normal. She said in between she's changed to different arms, and then she said something about putting a finger, I think, inside the cuff to make sure it was tight enough. So there was quite a bit of variability. What are patients maybe doing wrong, and what should they understand that they are doing something wrong?
Well, this may actually be okay. There is something called regression to the norm, and that just means with repeated evaluations, the numbers tend to get more towards normal. And so if the first one is 143 and the next one's 132 and the next one's 119, it may just be that your son is getting more comfortable and more used to this. Whereas, and it might not be a problem with the machine. So I would say, you know, the thing to do is keep checking on multiple times. Hope that your son gets used to it so he doesn't get as anxious when he first checks. But I would believe the 119 more so than the 143. I would think the 143 is anxiety and this white coat phenomenon that's very common where your blood pressure just goes up either because someone in a white coat's checking it or because you're nervous because your mom's checking it and you don't want her to tell you that you have high blood pressure.
Would it be reasonable to tell her to not be afraid to keep doing multiple things and take the lowest and but be consistent about how you do it in the time of day, for example, or not?
You know, I unfortunately, if you start to obsess, then that might actually increase the anxiety.
Okay. All right. So you're putting a lot of confidence in this sympathetic nervous system desires as causing a huge amount of variability in our blood pressures. And we want to be as relaxed, as calm, and as normal as we can be to see what our true blood pressure is.
Absolutely, because we don't want to treat someone because they're anxious. We want to treat what's happening 99% of the day. I mean, for most of us, anxiety is a fleeting moment. Not for everyone. There are people who, you know, are very stressful work environments. I'm sure if I was an air traffic controller, I might have high blood pressure all day long, and then at night it might be normal. And then that patient, I would want to know, is the high blood pressure damaging an organ? So I might get an ultrasound of the heart to see, is the heart muscle thicker? Or check an ultrasound of the neck arteries to see, are they thicker? And that person might need treatment during the day because of a, you know, very stressful job situation. But for a young man who, you know, a teenager, hopefully they're not under that much stress. And I think I would rely on that last blood pressure, kind of, you know, do three in a row, see where you're at, and realize that they're probably doing okay.
We're going to have to take a short break. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Those who are on have a call into us, if you'll hang on. We've got a couple more emails. In Anchorage, our number, again, just to remind you, is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@kska.com. After this very short break, we'll continue to take any calls and emails and talk with Dr. Jeremy Gittimer. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Jeremy Gittimer. He's an Anchorage kidney disease specialist, and he also treats hypertension, both in children and adults. Our topic then is hypertension. We had planned on maybe getting to kidney stones. I have a strong feeling we're not going to get there, so I like, if we possibly can, just to limit any questions and comments to hypertension at this point. You can email your questions and comments to us at line1@kska.org. You can give us a call at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, at any time, you can go to ksk.org and listen to the podcast. I know you can also get to it from iTunes. But if you're listening to it on the radio between 7 and 8 on Monday night, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we will not be here to answer your questions. So if you have comments or questions, this is the time to give us a call right now. I had a couple of questions about hypertension in pregnancy, and here is an email that gets us into that topic. It says, how common is hypertension after pregnancy? Is it likely to normalize if it's happened apparently for the first time? Would you recommend taking medication for a blood pressure of 150 over 85, 6 weeks after giving birth, and does it make sense to see if it'll come down naturally with weight loss? She's would rather not take any medications due to breastfeeding.
Well, hypertension in pregnancy is complex. There are people who develop pregnancy-induced hypertension, so it's just because they're pregnant. And there's no reason why. They're a little bit predisposed to having hypertension down the road, but it generally resolves after delivery. Then there are many women who are actually found to have hypertension during pregnancy, but because they were healthy, they weren't going to the doctor previously. And as we evaluate them, we find that they have either kidney disease that was hidden or some type of endocrine problem that causes high blood pressure. So if it's 6 weeks after delivery, you're 150 over 85, you're a young woman, your stroke and heart attack risk are very low. Now, you want to make sure that your family history doesn't have someone who has a stroke or heart attack at a very young age. You'd also want to make sure that you don't have a history of a clotting disorder, because those people can get into trouble at young age. But I think probably just for some watchful waiting with a low-salt diet, and low-salt is 2,000 milligrams or less. It's very interesting in societies that have 2,300 milligrams of sodium, we see high blood pressure commonly. If you look at societies that have 1,200 milligrams of sodium intake or less, you don't find high blood pressure at all. So a low-salt diet would be reasonable. Weight loss, if you're smoking, stopping smoking. I think those are reasonable, and you know, you have to, of course, think of the baby. The drugs are actually pretty safe. We use a lot of them in babies, but you know, I think your risk of a heart attack or stroke over the next few months is low. Now, if it's not gone by 12 weeks and you're back down to your pre-pregnancy weight, you've got it. And a lot of people don't want to hear that news. And we see a lot of women who had high blood pressure during pregnancy who kind of get lost afterwards because they're busy with their kids. So I think it would be important just to make sure that that's followed carefully.
Okay. The salt business is something that I think we should perhaps discuss a little bit more. I have a number of phone calls now. We've stirred up a hornet's nest, and I want to try to get to them. But I really want to make sure we talk about prevention. And I've wondered how most of the American audience would respond to these kinds of comments that recently were made in an editorial in the New England Journal about sodium. And it said a regulatory intervention designed to achieve a salt reduction intake of 3 grams per day, that's 3,000 milligrams, would save roughly 250,000 quality adjusted life years and almost $24 billion in healthcare costs. That's just decreasing salt intake. Such an intervention would be cost saving even if a modest reduction of 1 gram per day were achieved gradually over the next 10 years and would be more effective than using medications to lower blood pressure. I have a feeling you agree with this.
Well, absolutely. I think that when you look at the society, it's very interesting. I came from the South. The average African-American in Houston, Texas, ate 12,000 milligrams of sodium a day. And hypertension was rampant, as was kidney failure because of high blood pressure and sudden death and early death. And these were preventable. And this is, you know, was something that we saw. The average Caucasian in Houston, Texas, ate 8,000 milligrams a day. Everything's fried, so lots of salt. And it's very interesting. When you look at the diets, the DASH diet, if you reduced your sodium intake by 1,000 milligrams, 2,000 milligrams, or 3,000 milligrams, the reductions are only pretty modest. It's a 2 millimeters for the first 1,000 that you reduce, another millimeter for the next 1,000, and another 2 millimeters for the next 1,000. So if you reduce your own sodium intake by 3,000 milligrams a day, you get about 5-point reduction, which isn't a whole bunch. Some people will get a lot more if you're on a medicine like an ACE inhibitor, which is like lisinopril. This is a very commonly used drug. If you are on that and you reduce your sodium intake, you'll actually probably drop your blood pressure 15 points. Now, each pill you take is generally 12 points. So when we're looking at a society, reducing the blood pressure 5 points is a big deal, and it would be tremendously beneficial. Just to put this in perspective, and let's only use the top number. The top number is the most important if you're over 50. If you're under 50, it's the bottom number. The top number, if you go up on your blood pressure by 20 points, you've doubled your risk of heart attack and stroke. This is data from life insurance companies from 1900, and it's actually still valid today in patients who are followed in the large databases, the Framingham database. Conversely, if you reduce your blood pressure by 20 points, you have caused your stroke risk and heart attack risk to be dropped in half. Now, 5 points is going to give you about a 15% reduction in heart attack and stroke risk. So as an individual, that doesn't sound like a whole bunch, but when you look at the entire society and 80 million Americans with high blood pressure, what we find is that's a huge savings in terms of morbidity for these patients. They're, you know, just to decrease stroke risk and heart attack risk by 15% for our entire society is tremendous.
Tracy, you're on line one. Oops, he left us. Let's go ahead and take Jolynn. Jolynn, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, you answered my salt question. I also have a question about losing weight. If I lose weight, will I effectively cure my high blood pressure? Or what does weight loss do?
Yep, good question.
That is a great question. So weight loss is variable. But in general, if you lose 22 pounds of weight, you will drop your top number blood pressure by 10 points and your bottom number blood pressure by 5 points. So it kind of depends on how much weight you need to lose. First off, if you only need to lose 5 or 10 pounds and your blood pressure is 170 over 100, that's not going to get you to where you want to be. However, you will be a lot easier to treat and you'll need less medication and you'll feel better about yourself. So weight loss is very important. Even 5 to 10 pounds can drop your blood pressure 5 to 8 points on the top number.
How do you know, say I'm on blood pressure medication and I drop some weight, should I go off of it and then measure my blood pressure? Or?
Well, I think that's when you have to determine what your risk is for a heart attack or stroke. Let's say that you're a diabetic who's 70 years old and you've already had a heart attack. Absolutely not. Lose the weight, watch your blood pressure, and then if your top number is getting into the 110 range, maybe the bottom number is getting below 70 into the 60s, that's a good time to talk to your provider about backing off on your medications. Now, if you're a 35-year-old who's healthy, who doesn't smoke, who doesn't have high cholesterol, you could always try and withdraw your medicines. But in general, I think the easier thing to do is to lose the weight and then see where you're at. Sure. The mistake we've had in medicine for high blood pressure has been that the patient comes in at 150 over 100 for 5 years in a row and never gets put on treatment because it's kind of an uncomfortable situation. You know they don't want it. They've never been diagnosed with anything chronic in their life. There's a lot of psychological barriers. As hard as it is to believe, when they've done psychological profiles on people when they're diagnosed as high blood pressure, they actually feel the same way as someone who's diagnosed with cancer. And it sounds crazy, but it's real. And the reason it's real is because it's generally younger people who don't have anything else wrong with them. So, you know, once you get diagnosed, I think then the struggle is to stay on the medicine and keep yourself healthy. But it's always fun when someone is able to withdraw. But do that with your provider.
Will do. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call, Jolynn.
All righty. Bye.
Jeff, what can we do for you?
Hi, you have to excuse me. I kind of have an unfocused question, but it's in relation to my mother. She has high blood pressure, but she also has had a lot of thyroid issues. Is there any any input that the doctor can give on that?
Well, thyroid problems are very common. And if you look at high blood pressure, the thyroid does a few things. One, when it's underactive and underreplaced, so-called hypothyroid, the kidney will actually conserve salt and water. And in fact, patients who are very hypothyroid will get swollen. It's something called myxedema. And they tend to have high blood pressure. If you're overactive or overreplaced, then these patients tend to have high blood pressure because everything gets revved up. They have fast heartbeats. They tend to have increased sympathetic tone. And they also have excess salt and water held onto in the bloodstream by the kidney. So thyroid disease can definitely cause kidney. Now, if you're or cause high blood pressure. If you are on replacement, it's probably not the cause at that point. And it's very common for diabetics to have high blood pressure and thyroid disease. It's also common in the as you get older. And just for example, if you're 60 years old, you've got a 50 to 55% chance of having high blood pressure. If you're 70, you've got a 70 to 75% chance of having high blood pressure because your blood vessels get stiffer as you get older. You know, they've just been kind of worn out and they turn into lead pipes. And so as the blood is released from the heart, blood vessels can't stretch and accept that blood and dissipate the pressure. So you get these kind of bigger top numbers and lower bottom numbers. And those are harder to treat.
Thank you for your input.
Yep. Thank you. Here's an email. What are the chances of reversing early stage kidney disease with weight loss, exercise, and blood pressure control? She does not, the email is not tell me what kind of kidney disease she has.
Well, I think the chances are very good. And this has been well studied. There is a Italian researcher, Giuseppe Ramuzzi, who runs a remission clinic. And it's forward thinking. I like his data. He basically says that this is all the kidney disease is just blood vessel damage in the filters of the kidney. And if you have blood vessel damage, we have agents that should be able to reverse this. For example, ACE inhibitors will tend to take blood vessels that are thicker and make them thinner over time by reducing the growth factors that are produced in damaged tissue and by lowering the blood pressure. Statins, the cholesterol-reducing medications, have an anti-proliferative effect on blood vessels. This is why when you start someone on a statin in a study, you can tell within 2 weeks the group who's on the statin versus the one who's not by decreases in heart attack rates. And this is the anti-inflammatory effects. Obviously, cholesterol reduction in 2 weeks won't prevent a heart attack. So this is a different and it's a beneficial side effect of the medication. And so weight loss, aggressive blood pressure control, aggressive cholesterol control, avoidance of tobacco, and probably uric acid control, which is associated with gout, which is another inflammatory mediator on blood vessels. If you control all of those, in my experience, we've been able to have 40% of the patients who I see actually have improvement in their kidney function, and many go into remission.
It's interesting. Another question. My 82-year-old mother has had high blood pressure that does not seem to be well controlled by medication. She's had various combinations of medicine for many years and still has a blood pressure that bounces around. Good for her is about 145 over 85. Unfortunately, with no real reason, she can jump to 200 over 105. She's had the best results with a drug called clonidine, but that is not always effective. The up and down can vary from day to day at various times of the week. She seems to calm and be steady. I'm not sure where that was, but she's not been able to get a handle on this over the last 4 years. What do you think about this up and down blood pressure? And at her age, we're very concerned about stroke.
Well, I think stroke concern is very legitimate. There is very little data on people 80 and older for the ideal blood pressure. In fact, right now, if you look at the literature, there's a big debate going on. Most people are siding with a top number between 140 and 160 once you're over 80 as being the goal, and not to be under 140 as if you were younger than 80. And this is because the bottom number, the diastolic blood pressure, once you drop into the 50s and low 60s, there's a significant increase in stroke and heart attack. The heart attack makes sense because all the oxygen delivery to the heart happens at the bottom number. It doesn't happen during the top number. So it's during the relaxation phase of the heart. And so if your bottom number gets too low, you just can't deliver enough oxygen to the heart. So first, I would say you should have an appropriate goal, and 140 to 160 is generally now accepted as an appropriate goal. The second question is, why does she bounce a lot? And I guess I would say make sure that she's not bouncing when she eats salt. So if you eat a lot of salt, your blood pressure will go up. Because when you eat salt, it only goes into the bloodstream. It does not go into the cells of your body. The cells actually have no salt, or very, very little. And so as you eat salt, when it gets into the bloodstream, it makes the concentration of particles in your bloodstream increase. And since it didn't go into the cells don't increase. So the body wants to be in balance, and the brain will then send signals out to make you thirsty, to make you conserve water, so that you'll drink water to dilute out that salt and make the particles per square inch essentially the same in the bloodstream and in the cells. And that expands the blood volume. So if she eats some Cajun chicken and then gets a blood pressure 200, I would say this is because of salt intake during that meal. The other thing to watch for would just be changes in kind of anxiety level. And you don't want to check a blood pressure if she's uptight. If she's relaxed, that's a good time to check it. But I would say look at her salt intake. Make sure that you concentrate aggressively on that. Clonidine blunts sympathetic tone. So a good combination might be an alpha-beta blocker. These would blunt the effects of epinephrine on the body. That'd be something you'd have to talk to your provider about to make sure that they are not contraindicated.
We have a request to make, have you, if you would mind making comments on some of Dean Ornish's dietary suggestions, particularly his heart disease reversal diet, which is more, the writer comments, it's probably a more low-fat vegetarian diet.
Right. So Dean Ornish has published outstanding data, and so has Lance Gould, who was at the University of Texas. And I was privileged to hang out with Lance. So I'll speak more of this. It's the same type of idea. We took patients who had terrible heart disease, lots of cholesterol in the blood vessels, and he would put them on a strict diet. And this was a weight loss diet that was very low fat, vegetarian, very low in animal proteins, and low in salt. Took people about 2 hours to make all their food every day. And that's the same with Dean Ornish. You really have to make all your food. You can't purchase anything prepackaged. Then they have relaxation and meditation. And at the same time, there's aggressive medical intervention. So it's not just dietary, but there is cholesterol reduction, there's blood pressure control, they're making sure you're taking your aspirin to prevent heart attacks. And when you look at the patients 3 to 5 years later, they definitely can reverse their cholesterol burden. Now, unfortunately, only about 6% of all patients who were enrolled can actually complete the whole trial and actually participate fully. But even if you can only participate partially, it would be beneficial. But you won't get the same effects. So I have a lot of patients who say, well, you know, I'm not eating red meat anymore. Well, that's not going to, you're not going to have the same results as the Ornish diet. You know, then you're probably going to need the statin to reduce your cholesterol. You're not going to do it with just diet. And so a lot of people want to kind of pick and choose, and you really have to follow the whole program. But it is very beneficial, and I would encourage people, if you have the time, the energy, and there's a little bit of money involved because it's pretty expensive to do all of this yourself. But if you're interested, I think it's definitely worthwhile.
I'm surprised we haven't heard more of Dean Ornish. I don't really get that, and despite his discussions. I saw a video of him talking on TED. I don't know if people know what TED is, TED. It's a series of experts who talk in California and get invited, and it's really remarkable. And what I also remember about some of his early studies is they were looking at angiograms of people who were really the first people he was treating couldn't walk across a room without pain, and they have blinded different observers reading these angiograms afterwards showing reversibility in these things, which was pretty impressive stuff. Now, I understand that the diet is difficult, but it was some remarkable things that you don't hear much about, it doesn't seem to me.
Well, it makes you think about Europe. You know, you retire early, you drink a lot of wine, you're relaxed, you know, they have less cardiovascular disease than the U.S. And, I mean, there is something to be said for having time to relax and letting your sympathetic tone drop and, you know, eating a better diet. I think there's significant validity. It's just in our society today, these are very difficult to accomplish.
Well, let's talk about this stress and relaxation and, if you don't mind, biofeedback and where those things fit and why they may be helpful.
Well, you know, the body has multiple parts, and it wouldn't surprise you that the nervous system is involved in high blood pressure. And if you're stressed out, of course, your blood pressure goes up. And if you're stressed out all the time, your blood pressure's up all the time, and that can injure your organs. So there have been some nice studies. The simplest one is isometric exercises. I have a lot of patients say, I can't exercise. So there's a biofeedback mechanism where you take your hands and you just grip them together and then pull them apart as hard as you can. And you do this for 15 seconds on and relax for 10 seconds. And you do this for 5 minutes every day, or actually the study was 3 days a week, and you reduced your blood pressure by 8 points, top number. If you could do it every day, you dropped it by 12 points, which is a pill. Now, this is just biofeedback. It's actually probably the isometric exercise was important, but probably more important was I stopped doing everything I was doing that day. I didn't think about all the mess, you know, I wasn't worried about the economy or what's going on in Iraq or anything like that. I just concentrated on myself for 5 minutes, and I was able to relax and do this. There's also a device that can be purchased online that is a hand grip throttle that you grab, and it kind of tells you to grip harder, grip slower, grip harder, grip slower, and it reduces blood pressure by about 7 to 8 points. Top number also. So I think biofeedback is important. You know, massage lowers blood pressure by 3 to 5 points. Acupuncture lowers blood pressure by 3 to 5 points. I think these are all relaxation techniques.
So we need to take some time out every once in a while for ourselves.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't take a lot of time. It is what your thoughts are about that. It just needs to be consistent and a little bit of getting away from it all, at least in our heads.
I think 5 minutes a day is not too much to ask if you're taking three blood pressure pills.
Yeah. And you were saying that some evidence, when you said it's one pill, it's equivalent to our best treatment with medication at this point is to do that, not to tell people to stop their medication. I don't want to miscommunicate, but that there is significant benefit from this, and it may allow less invasive treatment from us white-coated guys.
Absolutely. You know, the average American is on 3.2 medications for blood pressure control, which, you know, when people first get diagnosed, they think one pill will cure them. But the data is pretty clear. The first year you're on one medicine, by the third year you're on three. And it's because the damage has been ongoing for many years before you started your treatment. And then once you're on your treatment, even though we are probably preventing a significant worsening, we probably aren't getting your blood pressure to the degree down low enough that you're reversing some of these injuries. So if you can do anything to get off of 3.2 down to 2.2, you have less risk of side effects. Probably you'll have a little better, you know, sense of well-being that you were able to do this.
Usually I put my guest website up on the our kska.org/line1 website so people can link to it. This week I forgot. Do you want to give us an office phone number and a website if you've got it?
The website is www.khcalaska.com.
Okay.
Kidney Hypertension Clinic, Alaska.
Alaska.com. Okay. Okie doke. There is one kidney stone question. I'm going to not get through everything. I think I should go ahead and ask this. I'm a healthy 35-year-old female. I passed a very painful kidney stone a couple of weeks ago after spending a half a day in the emergency room. Is there anything I can do from prevention or preventing having another one? I just thought that was the classic question.
That's a good question. First, make sure there's no reason for the stone. So you should be evaluated for an elevated calcium level and hyperparathyroidism. Let's ignore that, though. Simple things, low-salt diet. The less salt you eat, the less calcium will go into your urine. So you should try and definitely get on the 2,000 milligram or less salt diet. You want to drink at least 3 quarts of fluid a day because, assuming it's a calcium stone, the calcium had to bump into a negatively charged something, either oxalate or pyrophosphate. And so if you drink more fluid and you have more urine, it's harder for the calcium to bump into anything else accidentally. The next thing is, do not, under any circumstance, limit your calcium intake. The data is very clear. When you limit calcium intake, you increase the number of stones because calcium in your diet binds to oxalate in your gut, and it prevents oxalate from being absorbed. And oxalate is really what causes most stones. So you want to make sure you don't limit your calcium. Avoid excessive vitamin D. Vitamin D is the rage right now. Everybody wants to be on it. But you don't want to take so much that your bloodstream calcium levels go up. And then make sure that someone evaluates you for either evidence of hyperparathyroidism or sarcoidosis. Sarcoidosis is a rare disorder that allows your body to make vitamin D active and your calcium levels go up. So these are simple things that any provider should be able to evaluate in you. But low salt, lots of fluid, low protein diet's also beneficial. And then don't limit the calcium.
And I want to have you say again the idea about too much vitamin D. There's this human nature idea that if something is good, more must be better. And one of the talks I gave about asthma and allergies and vitamin D is somebody did a study, a long-term study of a large group of people, and as vitamin D levels went up, all causes death rate went down. But once it got past about 60, started going up again. So we can do too much vitamin D, too. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Absolutely. Vitamin D, when it's working, its job in the gut is to increase calcium absorption. Okay. And if you don't put it into your bone, it has to go somewhere. And basically, you've got to get rid of it. So it's in your urine. And that's a problem if you have kidney stones.
How do you go about or recommend patients estimate the amount of sodium that they're getting in their diet? I've really not done that, and I don't know how to. So what's any secrets on simplicity?
Well, the easiest thing to do is if you're unsure and you think you're eating a healthy diet, because people always tell me I'm eating a healthy diet, and I say, no, you're not. And I just get a 24-hour urine, and I measure how much sodium's in their urine. And that's the proof. What you eat, you will get rid of that day. And so that's a good way to determine it. Otherwise, I think just looking at labels. I mean, I was in the airport and I bought a sandwich from a really good restaurant thinking this would be healthy, and it had 3,000 milligrams. Okay. So you have to just look at your labels and be prudent. Anything that's manufactured has salt because it's a preservative.
And try to keep less than 2 grams a day?
2,000 milligrams, 2,000
2 grams. Okay. Thanks very much. This has been fantastic. I hope everybody got as much out of it as I did. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure to be here.
Next week, we're going to return. We're going to explore Alzheimer's disease. The topics will include normal aging in the brain, early signs of Alzheimer's disease, and caring for and treating patients. So why don't you join us Monday, December 6th at 2 p.m. on the next edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program and manned the phones. Thanks for listening, especially to those of you who took the time to call and email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.